been over at Little Rock in 40, Kit, and we traveled in the worst Pullman cars. You know, the South was pretty well beat then, and the Southern League was a tough cookie to travel in and play in. And to come to Louisville and now be back in the in a more plush surroundings, we used to take that 400 train out of Chicago to Minneapolis, and I'd never seen anything like that. I couldn't believe you got paid to ride on this thing, besides just riding on it and having some fun. Look up at that beautiful Mississippi River, and it was, to me, a hell of an experience. This is living, boy. I don't see how anything can be any better than this. Well, the first trip we took into Minneapolis, Tom Sheehan managed the Minneapolis club. He's the man who signed Willie Mays. And he was a veteran baseball man, and Mike Kelly, who owned that club, had nothing but veterans, guys who played 4 or 5 years in the big leagues. And we used to call Sheehan Liver Lip. He had a big hanging lip, and he was always growling at everybody. We went into the Nicollet Hotel. Here we are, just a young club. We got Pesky and myself and Houston, and it's completely young ball club. And here's Sheehan waiting as we come in from the cabs, and he says, "Boy, I'm sorry for you guys. Nice young men like you coming in to play a club like us. Nice, you're going to get your ass whacked." You know, this is the way he was. And he visited with Burwell for a while. He said, "That son of a bee." So we go out there on a Saturday afternoon and play him. We were there for Saturday and two on Sunday. First game they beat us 23-2 on Saturday. I never saw balls fly out of a ballpark. It was only 3-10 to center field, you know. And Wright and
Spencer Harris was probably there.
No, I don't think Spencer Harris was over there. Fabian Gaffke. Those balls were flying out of the air. I'm telling you, you'd say, "Good Lord, they're going to break all the windows over in those doors." So now we're down 23-2, and we're beginning to think maybe Sheehan knows something. We come out Sunday afternoon for the doubleheader, and the first game is Judd against Joe Hatton. And Oscar beats him 2-1. Now they've got 24 runs, and we've got 4, and the series is even going into the third game. Now Houston is going to pitch the second game against the big Chief Hogshead, toughest left-hander. The meanest, toughest son of a bee of a left-hander. I mean, you ask any veteran left-handed hitter, Williams or anybody, who's the toughest guy they've ever faced, and this is the guy. I don't care.
Why, because he threw at you?
He'd throw at you. He'd love that. But also, you couldn't pick his ball up well. He came from behind his back, and you never got a good picture of the ball on Hogshead.
What did he throw?
Fastball's his best pitch.
Oh.
Like most pitches. So now the series is tied, and we're in the clubhouse between games, and Burwell is making the card out. He says, "Houston, where are you?" Tex says, "I'm in the shit house." He says, "What are you doing in there? Are you sick?" "No," he says, "but he says, I figure if I sit in here long enough, that ballpark's going to look pretty big when I go out to the mound."
How did he do?
Shut them out 1-0. So we make 5 runs, they make 24, and we go walk out of Minneapolis for the series. Now we say to ourselves, "Hey, wait a minute now. We're not so bad. You know, these guys aren't going to push us around. We're just kids." And Columbus won the thing. They beat us by 2 games, I think, for the. And of course, they had Grodzicki and Brasheen and. Real fine ball club. But then again, we went ahead and beat Minneapolis in the playoffs and went to the finals with Columbus. But that's the way Houston was. He had that little deviltry about him, you know. And he just walked out in that ballpark and slammed the door in their face. That's all there is to that. And it wasn't long. I think 2 or 3 more ball games in 41. And then he went to Boston for the 41 season. But 42 was his, as you said, the year he had the real good year.
What was his best pitch?
Fastball.
Did it ride? Did it sink? Did it bore in on hitters?
Well, he could throw the ball. Well, we got to talk about that a little bit, I guess. I got to go around the barn a little bit. I am a complete nut on the pitch which is being thrown today called a slider. we're having people like Rosema, Fidrick, we're getting any number of rashes of sore arms because young men are trying to throw a pitch that's a 35-year-old man's pitch, because it takes too much out of the elbow and it stiffens the wrist in this thing that you're trying to slide. It's a very difficult pitch to control, and what we're really talking in essence, to get back to Houston, is that we're going to hold the ball a little bit off center. If we're right-hander and we want the ball to run in on the left-hander, we might be overloading the ball on the right side a little bit, which might make it, in other words, we're throwing a moving fastball instead of calling this a slider. When we're going to throw the ball, if we want to go away, we may turn just a little bit in here, but we're not continually going to keep doing this and tightening up this spot in here, which is what happens.
The rest of the
effort. Mm-hmm. So Houston had the ability. Why he had the bad curveball was that it was easier for him, the development of his arm was such that it was easier for him, the ball to ride in on the right-handed hitter. And so when he tried to get the reverse break on the curveball, his wrist was just not conducive to that. There are very few men who can break the ball both ways, that have a good curveball and have a good sinker. Because that you've got to have a tremendously flexible wrist. Chandler was a man who could do that. And those guys are devilish to hit at, of course. But his best pitch was his fastball, and the hitters that he got out the best were the right-hand hitters that he could crowd. He'd have trouble with a left-hand hitter more than he would, because you could see the ball a little better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this fastball would tail in on the right-handed hitters and saw the bat right out of
their
hand.
He just challenged it. And the nice thing about pitching inside like that is that if the guy gets the ball and bat around and gets the good leverage on the ball, you got to drive it foul. But you get that ball over the plate now, where you can get the leverage, you're not going to drive that ball foul. That's the ball he's going to hit for the home run over the left field fence. So the theory of pitching to power hitters is to pitch them inside. That's the place you pitch up power hitters. If you're going to throw them the curveball after setting them up with that, fine and dandy out away. But don't be throwing that fastball out over the plate. It's got to be in where you're going to reduce the leverage of the bat. Mm-hmm. And that's what he did best. He knew how to reduce the leverage once he learned that he wasn't satisfied. He didn't have to try to fool him. All he wanted to do was get him out now.
Mm-hmm.
So he wasn't going to show him, by God, I've got that curveball, I'm going to fool you, because it don't fool nobody.
Okay. Did he have any trick pitches to go with the fast one?
Fastball, curveball, change. That's all you need. That's all anybody needs to win. Today, yesterday, and tomorrow. And some mastery. By that I mean ability to get the ball somewhere near where you think you should.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's move on to Broadway Charlie Wagner. He was the number two winner of the staff. He had won 12 in 1941 and 14, came up with 14 in 1942 before he went away to the service. Want to comment on that?
Charlie was a real gutty pitcher. You know, he'd give you a battle. He wasn't a man with the ability of a Houston, and he'd be the first to tell you that. But he fought the hitter. He fought every hitter, and Charlie would load a ball on you once in a while. He'd cheat on you a little bit, and quick pitch in. He had pitched for Burwell, too. He was a man of product of the Burwell School of Pitching. And
so what you're saying is he got by on his head.
Oh, he knew how to. Well, yeah, he had. Well, in today's market, he's got a hell of a lot more than some of these people, the clowns that are pitching, like the name Comer, Langford. Good Lord, Charlie would stand like a giant side of those kind of people. But side of a Newhouser or Houston or Chandler, no. He lost a lot of ball games that year that one base hit could have won. I mean, he lost a lot of low-run ball games that were, you know, that's beyond the scope of a pitcher. You can't do much about that.
Mm-hmm.
But he was a good, fine, competitive pitcher in that league when that league was tough.
Mm-hmm. Joe Dobson?
Great curveball. Joe had that great overhand curveball. I never felt that Joe ever reached his full potential. I mean, he never had as good a year as his stuff indicated. He had much better stuff than Charlie, but he wasn't as good a pitcher as Charlie. He wasn't as intelligent as Charlie. You know, Joe's a fine guy, and I love him, but he just didn't have Charlie's smarts when it comes to pitching. And,
mm-hmm.
and he'd always throw that pitch. He'd get behind, and he'd throw that pitch and get hurt on it. And long ball type.
You say that pitch to curveball?
No, he'd come in and he'd let up on fastball.
Oh.
He wouldn't have the good stuff, you know. He'd be trying to get the ball over, and that's when he'd get hurt. but he had a superior curveball.
Mm-hmm. Dick Newsome had won 19 in 1941, but he really went downhill in 42.
Newsome,
Charlie Wagner has indicated that he wasn't that good a pitcher to begin with.
No, see, Newsome wasn't, that's right. See, Newsome, heck, Charlie, I wouldn't fault Charlie on any judgment that he'd make. Newsome was a veteran pitcher. He'd pitched in the Coast League for a long time, and he knew how to pitch, and he was a cheater. He was a spitball pitcher, a quick pitcher. He'd walk up in front of the mound if he could. He had a little trick that he always used to love to do, Kitten. I've never seen anybody else do it. With a man on third base, and you're taking the half windup, he'd come up and knock his hat off in the middle of the pitch to disconcert the hitter just every once in a while. And the guy's lap would be watching that hat go down. This is the kind of a guy. He was a conniver, and you have to say, with his ability, he went a long ways. But he's the kind of a guy you're going to have to get 7-8 runs to win for. It'll be 7-5.
So he didn't have good natural stuff.
Oh, no, he didn't. At that stage of the game, he might have 5 or 10 years earlier. I never saw him then, but Charlie's evaluation, in my opinion, is exactly correct.
So you think that after a couple of times around the league,
that's
they
right.
began to catch
yeah,
up?
Yeah, they realized that he didn't throw as hard as they thought he did, and they could lay back on him and wait and make him get the ball over. He tried to make you hit balls all the time.
Hmm.
He's like John. You know, he wants you to hit the bad ball. He doesn't want you to hit a strike. And the ball looks, it's got the illusion of a strike, but it's just enough out of the strike zone that you're going to beat the thing in the ground. And that was Newsom's game.
Mace Brown came over from the Pirates and did a good job in relief. He won 9 and lost 3. Do you want to comment on Mace? He was an old hand.
Just a fine, fine guy. If we got time to
add
a thing or two on him. But he's a very, very enjoyable person. He had... I think maybe I told you this story. Anyway, when he was a kid, he lived out in Iowa. Some little town way out in the sticks in Iowa. A little bit of a high school. And after baseball practice one day, he's walking by the track, and the track coach says to him, "Hey, here's a javelin. Let's see how far you can throw it." And he says, "I picked the thing up and flat-footed threw it." And the track coach says, "You can throw the javelin farther than anybody I've seen. You want to go to Chicago and throw in the big scholastic thing at Soldier's Field?" And Mace says, "I've never been to Chicago." And I said, "There's a chance for a trip." He says, "Yeah, I'll go." So he's going to be the representative of the school in a big track meet in Chicago. And Mace said that the station was a whistle stop, a flag stop on the railroad. So he's standing there with one of those "I hope it don't rain" suitcases and a javelin in the other hand on the platform, and here comes the Chicago Express. And they grind to a halt, and the engineer looks out and he says, "What's going on? Where's the passengers and all of this? We got to get going. I've got a schedule to meet." And the guy says, "Here's the guy, the station master says, this guy's getting on." Now May says, "I try to get in and I can't get the javelin in the vestibule." So the station master's got to go back into the station and get a crowbar and one of those rusty windows on those old trains, you know, and lift the window, and the fireman's yelling and the engineer's cursing them and the conductor's mad. And they finally get on the train. He says, "I get to Chicago. We're staying at the Palmer House." He says, "I get a cab and I've got to hold the javelin outside the cab going down through here." He says, "I've never been to the city before and here I am riding along with a javelin hanging out a cab." So he says, "We get to the Palmer House. They got a revolving door. We've got to send a javelin in through the mezzanine, and it's a big to-do." So as we finally go out to Soldier's Field the next day, repeat the performance with the cab, get out to Soldier's Field. He said, "And in the first heat, I got beat with the javelin. And the guy who won it came up and said, 'Gee, you got a nice javelin. Could I try it?' May says, 'You try it and take the son of a bitch. I never want to see it again in my life.'" And he says, "That's the last time I fooled with the camera." Well, anyway, he had pitched very well at Pittsburgh. And as you may remember, he's the guy who threw the ball to Hardin.
1938, the homer in the gloaming.
Yeah, that's right. And I don't know, you know, in my mind, I don't know if that did something to Mace. If it affected his confidence a little bit. In his curveball, he had a great curveball. A little bit better, I'd say, than Dobson. One of the great curveballs, as good as Bridges, almost. So when he came to Boston, he began to experiment with the slider. No, he's got a good curveball and a better than average fastball. So I think I mentioned in that thing with Ned Mudd. We play over in Detroit one day, and Bloodworth hit one up in that right center field stands about 100 miles, right-handed off him, and to be at the ballgame. And we're riding home in the cab, and I say, Mace, what was the pitch you threw to Bloodworth? He says, it was a slider. I said, well, how'd you come out with it? He says, well, it went out of the park. Well, I said, what's your best pitch? He says, my curveball. Well, I said, why the hell did I get beat on your best? What's the sense of getting beat on the second-rate one? Go home and eat your heart out. See, this pitch gets away from a pitcher a lot of times. And when it gets away from a guy out over, away from the leverage, out over the plate, this is the home run ball. Those sliders slide out of a lot of ballparks. And I thought that in that particular year, he might have used his curveball more than he did. I just wondered if, you know, he had lost a little confidence in his curveball, but it was still a great out pitch. Great.
And he was a smart pitcher.
Had great poise and never got rattled. He had fine composure. He had the things necessary for a good pitcher.
Oscar Judd?
Judd, same way, Canadian. And Judd got to be one of the funniest men I ever met in my life. I tell you a funny story about him, unless you would rather not. When he was over at Louisville with us in 41, Joe Glenn was over there with us as a catcher.
Wonderful man.
Oh, he's a beautiful.
I know him.
Did he ever tell you what Walter did to him?
No.
Oscar, I mean. Well, Oscar Judd and Walter Kazin roomed together on the Louisville club. And they were both practical jokers. Judd used to carry a drill with him, and he'd go around the hotel lobbies and drill holes in the pinball machine, and then take a coat hanger and run up about 100 free games, you know, and then play one and go over to the counter and work on the cash. Kazin, his roommate, was the same kind of a devil. So Kazin would come down into the lobby and he'd say, boy, that Judd is clever. He tapped my shoes this morning. He brings his own shoe stuff right with him in a suitcase. Terrific. He'd come down and he'd say, just got a nice haircut. That Judd, he can do anything. He's got the barber tools and suitcase. So we're in Milwaukee one day, and it's a Sunday morning, and Joe was quite a dude. He had that big head of black Polish hair, you know, and he featured himself as a pretty sharp guy. So we're standing down in the lobby, and along comes Joe, and he says to Walter Kazin, is Judd up in the room? He says, yeah. He said, you think he'd cut my hair? The barbershop's closed today. Now all is said, of all people to fall into the trap, we've got the old Yankee Clipper who had the lock aside of Gehrig, who's been regaling us about stories, Gehrig and McCarty and Dickie and them. So he says, I call up Oscar and say, Glenn's on the way up, get something ready. So he had a pair of nail clippers and an electric razor, and he took a towel and put it out on the dresser and a comb, and he's laughing so hard he's in the bathroom. He don't dare come out to face Glenn. So Glenn comes in and he says, where are you, Oscar? He says, I'm in the bathroom. He says, sit down. Walter's going to come up and do the rough work and then I'll finish you off. So in comes Kazin and he takes the razor, electric razor, and he's gouging big holes in Joe's head all over the place and shearing a clump out here and there, you know. It looks like a dog with a mane. And finally Oscar comes out and he takes one look at Joe and they burst out laughing, and Joe looks in the mirror and now he knows he's been had. So Joe came down in the lobby and he's raving. By now Judd's got all the ball players waiting down there. And Joe's saying, what a bush operation this is, what a bunch of rank bushes he's playing with to pull tricks like this and so forth. So now Judd and Kazin go out to the ballpark before Joe does. And Novikov is with the millions in Milwaukee club then. So they go over to see Lou and say, hey, can you speak Polish? He says, yeah, I can speak old Polish, why? He said, well, the first time you come up to the plate today, turn around to Glenn and in Polish ask him, who does your haircutting, Joe? So it's the first inning, Novikov's the third hitter, two men get out apple pie and we're going along fine, and up comes Novikov. He takes the pitch and he turns around to Glenn and he says, who does your haircutting? Joe takes his mask off and goes after him, and Novikov doesn't know, has no idea what the reason is, and they've got a round and round at home plate. They have to break up the time. But Judd was just, that's the kind of thing that Judd would do. So those kind of temperament people are great to have on the mound. They're going to beat you one way or another. They're going to cheat you, beat you, get you out, and Oscar pitched that play.
What was his best pitch?
Oh, I think maybe curveball. Yeah, maybe curveball. He was an older fellow then. He'd been in the Cardinal chain for a long time.
Oh, really?
He came over there in the... I'm trying to think the deal that sent somebody to the... Somebody went over to the Cardinals, and he and Reba, I think it was the forerunner of the Reba deal.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember the particulars of it.
Comment on Reba. He was often called the one-man ball club. In fact, I believe in 42 or 43, he caught a few games as well as...
Yeah, the guy could play every position. He was one of those old-time coal mine-type ball players who played a little bit of everywhere and had worked for Ricky and... If Ricky asked him to sweep the park out or whatever, Mike would do it. So he played third base, shortstop, any old place, driven the bus a little bit. And by the time he was pitching with us, he did not have good stuff. He was just getting by on his head, and he didn't have good stuff.
Why did Cronin keep him? Was he friends with Yawkey?
Well, let me say this. Mike was always a pretty good house man. He worked for the house pretty well, and he never rocked the boat too much, and he got along fine.
Because he stuck around until he was 43 years of age.
Well,
he stuck around until 46, and then became a minor league manager, I believe.
Yeah, I managed Louisville for a little while when I was at Toledo. Managed Scranton, I believe, before that. We're playing over in Yankee Stadium one day, and Peacock is catching, and the hitter is Keller. Bases loaded, and nobody out in the ninth inning. And if you get out of one of these things, you've got to be lucky, you know. Mike shook John off on the first two pitches. And on the third pitch, Mike's best pitch was a screwball at this stage of the game. He threw a screwball that was right up in Charlie's, right up around the letters. And Charlie hit it out of that ballpark 100 miles up in that right field stand. And we beat 4-3 or whatever it was. And we come in the clubhouse. And Reba says to Peacock, "What the hell did you call a screwball for?" And John says, "You old son of a bitch, that's the only thing you got. What the hell else can I call?" Peacock was mad. He said, "What else are you going to do? That's the only thing you could throw that had any spin or anything to it that might possibly get somebody out."
Uh-huh. I'm going to quickly go through the rest of the Sox pitchers that year if you want to comment on any of them. Comment on any of them, fine. Now, one was Bill Butland. That was really his only major league season. Yank Terry and Ken Chase. Chase had come over, I think, in the deal for Stan Spence.
No.
And Blackjack Wilson.
No, Chase came over on a waiver deal. Chase came over from Washington because Williams had trouble hitting him. And he said, "Hey, if you get a chance to get this guy, get him." And that's always the way they do with a great hitter, you know. They figure if they buy the guy, you can't get him out anyway.
Right.
Butland should have been one of the fine pitchers in the big leagues. Butland had good stuff and a good arm. And Bill just never, I never felt that he got a real good chance to prove himself. He could throw hard. And he was mean. I never could figure out why Button didn't pitch more than he pitched.
Of course, maybe 3 years in the service took something away from him.
Well, he wasn't in the service at that time.
No.
He hadn't gone yet. And I had played with him in Louisville, too. And he'd had a fine year for us over in Louisville. You know, a lot of that staff, I have to go back to Bill Burwell again. You know, so many of those young guys, he had Judd, Charlie Wagner, Butland, Houston. You know, that's a lot of work for one manager in the minor leagues. He's done a hell of a job.
Right.
Terry just had ordinary stuff. Terry was a guy who came to them when they bought the Louisville franchise in 39 or so. He and Reese were the only ones that had any quality on the club. And Terry was up in Scranton with me in 39 to help us try to win a pennant, and he never really pitched well. He was with L.A. when I was at Hollywood, and he pitched about the same in L.A. as he pitched for us. He had a good curveball, but he just never seemed to be effective, Chris, for some reason or other. Chase was a hard thrower. He was a milkman from up in Oneida, New York, or Oneida. and a dandy guy.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't have much curveball. He had to just overpower you. That's all it was to him.
Mm-hmm.
He was just a hard-throwing left-hander. I guess that's the best way I could describe him. We didn't get much help from him or Terry. They are pitching, in other words. I guess you when you go right back to it, it's the old pitching that kills you. And that's where the Yankees had the better ball club than us. They had Ruffin and
Bonham.
Chandler and Bonham and Kent.
Donald,
yeah, they had a couple of...
Russo was...
No, I don't think Russo was there
in
that year.
He was. He had arm trouble by that time.
And Gomez was there for a little while. No, he'd gone to the Braves in 42.
No, it was 43.
43. Well, I know he went over there sometime.
Tony, on the final day of the season, September 27th, 1942 to be exact, they had a Tony Lupien Day at the ballpark. I believe you were given a silver a platter, and they had 18,000 plus. Who gave the day for you? Was it the club, Harvard,
no,
or the fans?
No, I lived in Chelmsford, Mass. I was born and brought up there, and some newspaper man on the had a weekly paper there, and he decided that he would run a promotion. That he would collect money, and they'd give me a dollar for whatever every point that I was sitting. I don't know when I went 275 or something somewhere. So it was a hometown promotion thing, and it was a very very lovely thing for them to do. That was a lot of money in those days.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a very gracious thing.
That's very nice. Any other memories of that day?
No, not particularly.
Except the pregame ceremony?
Yeah, that's the way things were done. And they just, both clubs get up to home plate, they get a microphone out, and it was not the production elements that you see today of all the fanfare and everything. It was just an ordinary thing.
Tony, at this point I'd like to ask you, being a local collegian, namely a Harvard player, and a born and bred New Englander, put extra pressure on you as a Red Sox player?
Did it
help or hinder you?
I'd say it hindered me. I think there were two things that hurt me on that club, and that was one of them, and the other was following Fox. This is like following God. You know, you can't please anybody if you're a line drive hitter after following a man who can hit the ball downtown, a man who is so personable and admired and loved in that town. It's always good not to follow a star, and I had the misfortune of doing that. And also, I think being a local guy presents problems. I think it's much better to break in a town other than your own hometown. Might be a good place to go after you're a veteran.
How did the press treat you?
Spottily. I had a running feud with the Boston Globe, which was probably of my own making. And so I never, and to this day, the Globe has always given me a lot of crap, even to the last time I've worked over here at Dartmouth. The Herald treated me pretty well, and I thought Dave Egan treated me well, who was a pariah in those days. But
did the trouble with the Globe stem from your Harvard days?
Oh, a little bit of it, yeah.
I got
in an altercation with Mel Webb, who was a veteran writer for that paper. I guess he'd been writing for 50 years or so, and we got into a fight on the train one night. Not a fight, but a very miserable disagreement. And from then on...
The climate was sour between you and the Globe?
Yeah, we never got anything out of the Globe, and it's carried over for 35 years. So I never did any...
Who was your favorite among the writers? Or didn't you have one?
I don't believe I had any. I never... spent much time with the writers. I've always felt that a guy goes to the ballpark as a writer, he doesn't have to come to a ball player to ask him about the ball game. He saw the ball game, report what you saw.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's very unfair now at the present time, and it's in the contract, I realize, that you have to give these people promotional time after a ball game. I think it's very unfair for a writer or a radio man to come and attack a ball player as soon as the game is over. It's a very upsetting period in a man's life, a time when he's liable to say things that he wouldn't normally say. And I just don't care for the privacy being taken away from a ball player like it has been today.
Okay. Let's move on to 1943. The Sox went from second to seventh. You were 68 and 84, 29 games back. Now, can I assume that the plunge from second to seventh was because of people like DiMaggio,
yeah.
Pesce, and Williams?
Right. You lose those three guys right off the top, and you lost Charlie Wagner.
Lost Wagner.
We lost the heart of our run-making ability and defense, because now we were playing with shortstops that would come along. We didn't have a stable lineup. We had, I think, Eddie Lake for a while, and
Skeeter Newsom, the regular shortstop,
but Skeeter couldn't play a long period of time. He had to take a day off. He was not a strong man, you know. He wasn't strong as Pesky, and he wasn't as young either.
And comment on Newsom's playing ability.
Newsom was a dandy utility man because he can play third, short, and second, and play them better than average. He can make the double play for you. He's not going to embarrass you defensively wherever he plays. He had been hit in the head before this time, and he was a little more unstable up at the plate than he might have been years earlier. I think he was a little leery at the plate. But he was an ideal utility man, not to play regularly. Good utility man.
Okay, now the guys who took DiMaggio's place were Catfish Metkovich and Leon Culberson. Do you want to comment on Metkovich and Culberson as ball players?
Metkovich was a good line drive hitter and a good day in and day out ball player. Of course, George too suffered from following DiMaggio. I mean, George would have looked a lot better with another club than he did with that club.